Jim Jarmusch is one of the few young film directors who's managed to make very idiosyncratic movies that are widely distributed and attract large audiences. New York Times film critic Vincent Canby called him the most adventurous and arresting filmmaker to surface in the American cinema in this decade. Jarmusch's movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and the new film Mystery Train. Mystery Train won the Best Artistic Achievement Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Jim Jarmusch's stories are offbeat, and so are the actors he casts. In fact, some of the actors are better known as musicians, such as Tom Waits and John Lurie, who scores Jarmusch's films and plays with the band The Lounge Lizards. The cast of Mystery Train includes Joe Strummer of the British band The Clash, and rhythm and blues stars Rufus Thomas and Screaming Jay Hawkins. The settings and stories of Jarmusch's movies are also influenced by music. Mystery Train is set in Memphis. The film opens with two teenage Japanese tourists who've made Memphis a stop on their rock and roll pilgrimage to America. They plan on visiting Graceland and the Sun Studios, where Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, and Carl Perkins all recorded. The parts of Memphis that Jarmusch shows are abandoned and run down. I asked him if he had made a pilgrimage to Memphis before he began making the film.
I actually hadn't been to Memphis until after having written the script for the film, so I wasn't really quite sure what to expect. But I'm always more drawn to the more unusual places in a city, or the back street kind of areas in a city.
Well, why are you more interested in the back streets of a city? That's not the kind of section you grew up in, is it?
Well, I grew up in Akron, Ohio, so I think I have some kind of innate nostalgia for, like, post-industrial landscapes or something. I like those kind of areas. It's funny because usually people film in cities and they try to film recognizable cliches of the city or recognizable landscapes so that people know that that's the city they're filming in. If you film in Seattle, you have to have a Space Needle. If you film in New Orleans, you have to have the Superdome Stadium or whatever. And I don't know, I just prefer to avoid the kind of things that most people would use as a kind of cliche or an identifying image of a city, because real people live in the back streets. They don't just visit the kind of places that you would see in postcards.
You said that you want your audiences to be more interested in character than plot. Why?
Well, I'm more interested in characters than in plots. I don't know why. I get kind of bored with the predictability of plots and the fact that you can usually guess what's going to happen in a film after the first 10 minutes. And instead, what's more interesting to me are characters. And my films are not about very complicated plots. They're not really story oriented to the degree of most films. Narrative films with characters in them are about people.
The characters tend to be pretty directionless. There's not a lot of action in your movies. Are you reacting against a certain kind of movie with that too?
Not so much reacting against it, because I like a lot of action films myself, but There seem to be so many of them that I would prefer to, I don't know, my interest leads me toward the characters rather than, special effects and action and that kind of stuff. I like the really simple things, little things that happen between people, often even between moments of dialogue. So I'm just interested in those things. I also have a bad habit that only occurred to me recently. When I'm watching films that are relatively predictable, I find myself not following the plot and imagining scenes that aren't in the film, but that might, things that happen as that would be transitional, but are not in the film. They're not necessary because they want to follow the action. And I kind of drift off and imagine all kinds of scenes that are not even in the films I'm watching, which then, of course, I end up missing the key scenes in the film. But I don't know. I'm just interested in I think insights often are more, there are greater insights just in those little spaces between things.
Can you give an example of an imaginary scene that you were diverted by in a recent movie?
I can't think of a specific example, but if you say you're watching a film and a guy has an argument over the phone with his girlfriend and it cuts back and forth between them, and then it cuts to him entering her apartment, I might stop to imagine, you know, how did he get to her apartment so fast? Did he walk? Did he drive? Did he take the subway? What was he thinking? Was he angry? Is it 1 hour later? Is it 5 hours later? And by the time I've imagined half of those things, I miss the scene that's going on between him and the girl in the apartment.
So your film might be more about the trip getting over to the girlfriend's house than about what happened afterwards or before.
Yeah, I think my films are, in a sense, made up of those in-between scenes that other people would eliminate. For example, in Down by Law, the film, there's a key in the plot. They escape from prison, and normally you would spend a lot of time developing, you know, how do they get out of prison? Do they carve a gun out of soap and dye it with shoe polish, or is there a file baked into a cake or whatever? And in my film, I just wasn't interested in exactly how they got out. I just wanted them to get out. So I pretty much eliminated all the plot detail. And in one scene, they're talking about the possibility of escape, and in the next scene, they're escaping. So I tend to leave out a lot of the action stuff, things that explain the plot, which really doesn't interest me so much.
My guest is film director and screenwriter Jim Jarmusch, and his new movie is Mystery Train. He also made the movie Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law. I have to say, I think your movies have a very low libido. Libido level.
A low libido level.
Yeah.
Gee, I don't know how to take that.
Well, no. Well, the films are seldom about the character's sexuality. And there's very little sex in the movies, and this is in a period when so many movies are explicitly or implicitly about sexual magnetism.
Well, it becomes so cliched, you know. What I don't like, and there's a sex scene in Mystery Train which I intentionally wanted to...
They seem very bored.
Well, they're not good at it, basically.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they're very young and they're not good at it, and it happens too fast, and then they feel funny about it, so they have a kind of invented argument because of their own insecurity, which the scene was about young, about being having making love when you're young and not really knowing how to do it so well. And the vulnerability that they feel just after.
Mm-hmm.
But, low libido level. But what bothers me are these Hollywood, you know, these kind of cliched sex scenes where everyone, it's like we are sexual athletes, and aren't we good at this? Which I find pretty boring. I mean, that's not really, sex can be so many different things. It can be funny, it can be frustrating, it can be annoying, it can be really wonderful. But in the movies, it's always like athletics, which, I don't know, I just find that boring.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking about how you're more interested in character than in plot, and I think you have a great sense of casting. You've worked with a lot of actors who aren't really actors, they're not trained actors. A lot of them are actually musicians or come from music backgrounds. I'm thinking of John Lurie, who also scores most of your films, Tom Waits, who co-starred in Down by Law, Joe Strummer from The Clash is in your new film. When you're looking for an actor who isn't a professional actor, what do you look for in them to give you the confidence that they'll do well in your film? Are you looking for their kind of attitude and style in a way?
Well, I don't really look for non-actors. I just tend to get ideas for people that I have some sense of already. They're either friends of mine or people whose work that interests me as an actor. So my films have a variety of different levels of experience among the actors. Some are very experienced and some are not experienced at all. But what I look for is something that will inspire me to create a character, basically. And most of these, many of the actors I've worked with, I've written characters specifically for them. Now, that doesn't mean that they are playing themselves in the film, but that there are certainly elements of their own personality that is also in the character, and there are elements of their own personality that is not in the character and is therefore suppressed or not not amplified like elements that would be in the character.
The first time I saw Richard Edson in a movie, it was in your film Stranger Than Paradise, and I guess it was 1984. And he's since become also known for his role as the non-racist son of Danny Aiello in Do the Right Thing. Tell me about casting him. Perhaps he was in movies before yours, but I don't think I saw them.
No, he wasn't. In fact, I think Stranger was his first role. And Richard is also a musician. And when I first knew him in the late 70s, early 80s, I knew him through music. He was in different groups in New York. So I don't know. He was just someone that I knew and who had a really a wonderful quality about him. And I thought he would be interesting for the character of Eddie in Stranger Than Paradise. And certainly now that I've made the film, looking back, I can't possibly imagine anybody else being that character.
We've been talking about how you cast a lot of musicians in your movies. You used to be in a band yourself, didn't you?
Yes. Next question.
What kind of band was it?
Oh, no. Next question about the film, please.
You don't want to talk about the band?
I'd rather not. It was very important to me being in a band, but I'm not really a musician. I consider myself a non-musician. I would like to do some music in the near future, too, but I don't really want people to go out and look for the records that my...
Oh, there's records, too.
Oh, see?
You shouldn't have given that away. We didn't know that.
I'm digging my own grave here.
You spent a year in Paris. I think this is when you were in college, is that right?
Yeah, my last year. I studied literature here in New York at Columbia. And then my last year, I went to Paris to study for one semester and ended up staying there for a year.
Were you introduced to many American films through a French perspective while you were living there?
Yeah, I was. In fact, a lot of American film directors, a lot of work of American film directors, my attention was brought to them through French writers or French Nouvelle Vague directors who were also writers. I would read something Godard wrote about Howard Hawks or Sam Fuller or something that Jacques Rivette wrote about John Ford, etc. And it's funny that my interest in American cinema came largely through first an interest in European cinema.
Do you think that that's affected the way you make movies? I mean, Mystery Train seems to be very influenced by Godard, especially the first segment.
Well, I'm sure it has, although I'm not the best person to be very analytical about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it has. I mean, I think I'm inspired a lot by European films and Japanese films, but also a lot by American films.
You studied with Nicholas Ray?
Yes, I worked as a teaching assistant with Nick Ray and was with him up until his death, for about a year and a half before his death, I worked with him.
His films include Johnny Guitar and Rebel Without a Cause. Is there any way you could summarize some of the things that you learned by working with Ray?
Well, I learned so many things. He taught me to think of each scene in a film as something, to concentrate on each scene as you're shooting it, as you're rehearsing it, and not to confuse them, not to think about, scene A, scene B, scene C together, but to isolate them while you think about them. He also taught me not to talk to the actors in a general way, that each actor should be dealt with individually because what you are doing is collaborating with that one actor to make a character. And what you speak to that actor about, you shouldn't necessarily let the other actors hear because it doesn't relate to their work. So he taught me to really concentrate on a kind of collaboration with each actor. He also taught me to that films should be influenced or inspired by things other than cinema, by literature, by painting, by baseball, by, whatever interests you, but most importantly, by observing and listening to dialogue that you just overhear in real places.
You met the German director Wim Wenders, who's made several American films, I believe through Nicholas Ray, because Wenders made a film about Ray called Lightning Over Water.
Right.
Wenders helped you out in making your first or one of your first films.
Well, Wim's company, which at the time was in New York called Gray City, gave me film material, film stock that was left over from a film that Wim made called The State of Things. So, and I met Wim through Nick, and to be honest, at first, when I was an assistant to Nick on the film Lightning Over Water, and hardly even spoke to Wim throughout that experience. But since then, I got to know him very well, and he's really a close friend. I really like his work a lot.
My guest is film director Jim Jarmusch, and his movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and the new film, Mystery Train. So you had this limited amount of film stock to get started and make a movie, and from the way I understand it, you shot the first part of Stranger Than Paradise using that stock, and to make every minute of it count, you instead of doing lots of takes and editing it down to just a few good minutes, you rolled the camera and used a good deal of what you shot. I know you were doing that at the time to save money, but what did you learn from taking that approach that's affected the way you make movies since?
Well, I learned that you should think of limitations as strengths, and therefore you can kind of defeat them as being limiting. I think that if you try to turn things around in that way, you can learn a lot. I'm very interested and inspired by a Japanese director, Ozu, that also Wim Wenders likes a lot. He made a film called Tokyo Ga that largely deals with Ozu. But Ozu used limitations to the extent that he used a single lens for all of his films, only one lens. He used only two camera positions, two heights of the camera off the floor only, and he never moved his camera. And yet his films and the language, the film language that is developed in his films is so strong and powerful and even elegant at times, and yet so minimal that by taking those limitations, he made something incredibly strong out of them. So I try to think in those terms, to use the limitations, to think of them as strengths, and not think of them as restraints, but something that could possibly make the film stronger.
Because one of your early films was shot with limited film stock and without a lot of retakes, have you incorporated that type of approach into your later films?
Yeah, I find myself, in fact, repeating a lot of things that I like. For example, in my very first film, Permanent Vacation, the only way that I could get a shot of the character walking down the street was to put the camera in a car and push the car along the street. So I had a very flat kind of angle on him with him in profile walking down the street and the landscape around him in the frame and the camera following him, which is something I again used in Stranger Than Paradise. I used it in the opening of Down by Law. I used it also in Mystery Train. And in Mystery Train, we had a good-sized budget, but we didn't have enough money for tracks to do traveling shots for all the scenes we wanted to. So we found ourselves again doing the same thing, mounting the camera in a car, a station wagon, and having six or seven people push it and doing traveling shots in this way. So there are certain things that repeat. Also, the idea that I really don't like to move the camera unless it is following a character. It's something just kind of idiosyncrasy that I have. I see other people do it, and it's sometimes really dramatic, and I like it a lot, but it's something I don't want to do. For example, if a character is sitting in a chair, I don't like the idea of traveling in on them while they're static for a dramatic effect. I only want to move the camera if the character is in fact moving.
Why not come in for a close-up?
Because for me, the camera then becomes a character itself. It's somehow I have broken a kind of observational thread between the audience and the action, and now the camera is telling the audience that this must be important because we are moving in on it, and therefore we are imparting meaning by moving the camera, which I think is somehow antithetical to the style, at least in the, I mean, I'm not saying I would never do that, but talking about the films I've made thus far, that would not be in keeping with the intention of the style.
You're one of those people who, one of the few people who's managed to have a film career without making big budget studio productions, yet have their films really be seen by a large audience. I mean, you're hardly an underground director now, so to speak. Is that the kind of area you'd like to stay in?
Yeah, I would. Although, I just want to be able to make the kind of films that I want to make without being told how to make them. So somehow I would not say that I would never want to make a film in a studio or with, you know, in Hollywood or whatever. I wouldn't mind doing that as long as I'm making my film. I don't want to make a film that someone else tells me to make for them that I just wouldn't be good at.
I want to go out with Elvis Presley's version of Blue Moon, which you play through the movie. Tell me why you chose that recording.
Well, I like the this. I could go into a very long-winded answer about my feelings about Elvis. I'm not a big Elvis fan, although I think he was a really great performer. I was more interested in him as an icon. But Blue Moon is particularly interesting because it's a very minimal arrangement of a Rodgers and Hart song, but using a very minimal rockabilly arrangement. And it's something that the minimalness of the instruments and the use of Elvis's falsetto I find particularly haunting.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for.
Jim Jarmusch's new movie is called Mystery Train,